Well, I know, right? I was a little bit obvious with my sermon title this week, just by thinking about it. You've seen the headlines, right? I mean, I had an idea that some people had this crazy idea they could do big things just by thinking about them, but I wasn't prepared for something on this scale. I mean, 81% of us think we're going to write a book someday? When the kids are gone, when we retire, we'll sit down and write ourselves a book. Without a class, without practice, without much of an idea, much less a rough draft. 77% of U.S. adults have not read or even listened to all or part of a book in the past year, but 81% of us are thinking about writing one. And this supposition that we can accomplish things just by thinking about them extends into many spheres, right? National security, for example, classification of documents, but that's not really of interest to me this morning. What is of interest is that this supposition about doing things just by thinking about them seems to extend to our faith. The idea that we don't actually need to do anything, don't need to take concrete steps, just think about doing it. So here's what I mean. In an article for Slate Magazine by NPR's Shankar Vedantam, Vedantam talks about Christian faith and church attendance in the U.S. Upward of 90% of all Americans believe in God, and more than 70% have absolutely no doubt that God exists. But only 2 in 5, 40% of Americans, say they regularly attend religious services. 40%, far fewer than say they believe in God. But still, 2 out of every 5 U.S. citizens attending church regularly makes us the most religious citizens of all industrialized nations. Just 2 in 5 attending religious services regularly makes us the most religious citizens of all industrialized nations. Except, Vedantam says, we are not. Because evidently, we think that thinking of ourselves as Christians and thinking about attending religious services is the same as actually doing it. Because here's what studies find. And they go through and they point out these very obvious things. For example, you know, we've got all these people telling us they're going to church, but what's happening in the churches? Attendance is declining and declining, right? Pews are emptier and emptier. If Americans are going to church at the rate they report, the research says, the churches would be full on Sunday mornings and denominations would be growing. So they decided to take this a little further, and instead of just asking people if they go to church or if they go to church regularly, they started asking them questions about what they actually do. So the surveys were changed to go something like this. I would like to ask you about the things you did yesterday from midnight Saturday to midnight Sunday. Let's start with midnight Saturday. What were you doing? What time did you finish? Where were you? What did you do next? And when they walk people through these questions, they find out, surprise, they were not going to church. In fact, about half the number that say they are religious, that say they are going to church, are actually going to church. About 20% out of the 90% who believe in God, out of the people who tell us that it's important to go to church, number one, because it strengthens your relationship with God, number two, because it offers a moral foundation for your children, number three, because it's a method of self-improvement, and number four, because church offers comfort in tough times. But only 20% of us who profess faith actually follow through. Religion in America, according to Vedantam, seems tied up with questions of identity in ways that are not the case in these other industrialized countries. So Vedantam points out that when you ask Americans about their religious beliefs, it's like you're asking them whether they are good people or asking them whether they are patriots. They will say yes, even if they cheat on their taxes, even if they're bilking Medicare for hundreds or thousands of dollars, even if they evaded the draft. Asking people how often they attend church, he says, elicits answers about their identity, who people think they are or ought to be, rather than who they actually are, what they believe, and what they do. We want to be people who go to church, but we just don't do it. This is on my mind right now because we just finished this sermon series based on Jim Wallace's book, Christ in Crisis, Reclaiming Jesus in a Time of Fear, Hate, and Violence. Now, Jim Wallace is an activist, and he offers chapter after chapter on his thoughts about faith in Jesus Christ and how a return to that authentic faith can rescue our nation from its uncivil wars. And I realize that our guest preachers have done a very good job of sharing Jim Wallace's faith journey with us. But I'm not sure we've done enough to encourage you to make your own faith journey, to reclaim or even to claim for the first time a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, or with Rabbi Jesus, or Jesus the scruffy renegade, whoever it is. Sometimes in a church as concerned with social justice as we are, I think we sometimes neglect personal faith as we talk about our corporate responses. We leave that personal faith stuff to the evangelicals, to the charismatics, to the conservatives. We prioritize our need for social action. But today I want to make sure and encourage you to walk the faith walk yourself. Fall down occasionally, get too close to the edge, fall over, sometimes fall, sometimes fly. And I want us to look at this story from Luke's gospel to get at what that might look like. This is from the 17th chapter of the Gospel according to Luke. On the way to Jerusalem, Jesus was going through the region between Samaria and Galilee. As he entered a village, 10 lepers approached him. Keeping their distance, they called out, saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." When he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were made clean. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, he prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus asked, were not 10 made clean? But the other 9, where are they? Was none of them found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? And then Jesus said to him, get up and go on your way. Your faith has made you well. We've shared this story many times over the years. Even I saw most recently 3 years ago when the Austin Gay Men's Chorus was here sharing some new music, and we used the opportunity to talk about the Samaritan who returned and how it's often those marginalized, those outcast who get right to faith, who return with gratitude, who express gratitude for being healed. But this morning, I just want to look at something really simple. 10 lepers approach Jesus, and they keep their distance as they're required to do, but they cry out for mercy. And who knows what they were expecting as they were crying out for mercy. That's all they asked for compassion. And I want to make sure you understand their plight. Leprosy, the wasting, killing kind that these men had, started with a small lesion, but then it ate away the flesh. It was literally a living death. And the most terrible thing about it, out of all these terrible things, the most terrible thing about it was the isolation that it brought. Lepers were required to cry out, unclean, unclean, wherever they went so that people could keep their distance. Those with leprosy were condemned to live alone in ghettos outside the towns. Those with the disease were banished from society, exiled from their homes, exiled from their families. Dr. A.B. MacDonald once wrote about leprosy. For some reason, there is an attitude to leprosy different from the attitude to any other disfiguring disease. It is associated with shame and horror and carries in some mysterious way a sense of guilt, although innocently acquired like most contagious troubles. Shunned and despised, frequently do lepers consider taking their own lives, and some do. So these 10 are coming along, and they're crying out for mercy, and Jesus has this odd response, don't you think? Go and show yourselves to the priest. They're asking for compassion. They're asking for mercy. Go and show yourselves to the priest. And as they went, they were made clean. Their leprosy, I guess, disappears. Their bodies are restored. And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back and took a hold of Jesus and thanked him. One of them. Can't you imagine the scene? You know, these 10 people, they're living through this incredibly strange experience. They're walking along because Jesus said, go show yourself to the priest. And maybe they had an inkling what was going on. I don't know. But go and show yourself to the priest. And they're walking along and they find that their bodies are healed of this disease. It's not hard to imagine that they're doubting it, right? They've been the subject of hate and derision and oppressive rules, and it's hard not to carry that stuff with you. Yeah. Even when you're better, even when you can see the evidence, it's hard not to carry that stuff with you. So they're walking along, and I'm sure they can still hear the voices calling them unclean, pointing fingers, horrified. I can imagine the other nine all the way to the temple doing what they were told, kind of saying, is it still holding? Am I good? What about this spot here? But one returns. Doesn't just think about it. Doesn't think, I'll drop an email to Jesus later in the week, or maybe even show up next time he's preaching. But he turns back, goes right up to Jesus, makes the connection, and then, only then, have you been following? Then, only then does Jesus say, your faith has made you well. When the leprosy is gone, they are clean, not well, not healed, not whole or restored, just no longer suffering from leprosy, which is big, yes. But when the one returns and takes hold of Jesus, his life is restored. He is well, healed, whole, with all that comes with it when he acted. I came across in my studying this quotation from the Buddha. I think it's so appropriate for today. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions simply because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. I think it is a good thing to study, to learn from a man like Jim Wallace or a woman like Dorothy Day or Bishop Charleston or on and on. But it is another to take hold of Jesus. This morning I want to encourage you to be the one that turns around and goes back and takes a hold of Jesus by doing the simple things, not just thinking about them, not just scheduling them, but doing them. Read the scriptures. I have recently given myself permission for the first time ever to read the New Testament book, starting with Acts, straight through, with no commentaries, with no one telling me what they mean. Because I have some ideas myself, and I have some thoughts myself, and I have some needs myself, and I want to see what the story tells me. So I'm just reading through, no commentaries, just my highlighter, and I've got several different colors because I enjoy that. And I've got one black pen that won't smudge if I write in my Bible. If you had told a younger me that I would write in a book, I would, oh. But now, and this is what I do 90% of the time. Question mark. Question mark. And I'll come back and I'll let some smart people try to help me figure out those question marks. But right now, they're my questions. And I'm living in them. And it's great. Just do it. And prayer. You know, I often have people tell me, I'm just not good at prayer. I'm just not sure how. I start to pray and then I get all distracted. And I remember something I read many years ago about prayer that said, if you are praying and you get distracted, pray about your distraction. So you're sitting there and you're, I'm going to pray because I'm going to do it 10 minutes every morning. I'm going to pray. But you just get started and then you're thinking about that meeting you got with your boss that afternoon. And my, oh my, why does my boss want to meet with me? We hadn't even been in person in months. But it is face to face. Yeah. Let your prayer become that. God, I don't know what's going on, and it's very stressful, especially at this time, but may I listen in the, and may I say the things that I need to say? And by the way, I know my boss has been under a lot of stress lately, and that could come through today because, you know, he's been a little short-tempered, but I want to have grace with that because I know where it's coming from, and I know, and let your distraction become your prayer. Here's the thing. We've been studying Jim Wallace's book, and I think that's wonderful. But what I want to try to do is be like that one who goes back on my own to grab hold of Jesus. Because I'm hoping that when I get close enough to grab hold of Jesus, he'll grab hold of me. And that's what I think the world really needs right now from me. Not for me to change it. Not for me to inspire its change. But for me to reconnect with my faith. For me to reconnect with the one who said, Karen, it's pretty simple. If someone's hungry, offer them food. If someone's sick, visit them. Offer a word of hope. That is what the world needs from me right now. Amen.